Hello, and welcome to I Thought They Smelled Bad on the Outside, a show that goes up to 11. With me today are two fine gentlemen. How about you introduce yourselves?
I guess I'll go first. Hi, this is Neo from the... some folks may know me from the Gundam podcast. I was asked to come on board here for today's topic, so thank you for having me. And if you don't know me before, you don't know my other podcast that I'm from, you know, check it out if you want. That's it. I just wanted to thank these two guys for having me on. So,
well said. I'm Scott, the other Scott, and just back again to talk some music and want to say, go team. Let's have a good podcast. Yeah,
110%.
So is it Scott 1 and Scott 2, or just...
He's Diet Scott, and I'm Scott Max.
Oh, okay. Or Scott 0?
No, I'm
or...
Scott Max because I'm bitter and over-caffeinated.
Okay.
His words, not mine.
That is fun.
No, this is the whole system, is that I know too many guys named Scott, and we seem to find ourselves in the same place often. So I've just started coming up with nicknames based on cola variants. So my boss at work is Scott, is Cherry Scott, because he's a ginger.
Nice.
Well, why don't you just call him Ginger Scott?
Because then the theme changes, and then we have to be Spice Girls.
Oh.
In which case, he's Sporty Scott.
Or you're not Spice Girls, you're Scott Girls. The Scott Boys.
Oh, no.
What is it?
You're sucking us into a bad alternate universe here.
Sporty Scott, Posh Scott. It was always my favorite. Posh. Still looks damn good, too.
Oh, yeah.
I don't care what anyone says.
Married to David Beckham.
Yeah, damn you, David Beckham. Yeah, she's older than him.
Really?
Not by much, but I think by a year or two.
Good for him.
Yeah.
I'd say we should break his legs, but apparently he'd get like $500 million for that.
You know
He's insured pretty heavily.
I don't have a problem with him. I'm not a big soccer person, and you know, because I live in the United States, the home of football, and you know, the true football, not soccer.
Not the one that you actually play with your feet.
Yeah. Hey. Hey, you kick the ball, the kickoff starts the game.
Field goals, punting.
Punts.
Yeah, fair.
Hey, when they have those games in the NFL in London, they go crazy when they see the ball punted. But
it's something they understand.
I know he's a divisive player in the whole realm of the soccer, you know, soccer fans and all that, but I know a lot of it is because he seems so more like a celebrity, but hey, he doesn't bother me, so I wouldn't break his legs.
And with that, let's go into pick of the week.
I'm not a mafia goon, so I'm not.
Yeah, exactly. We might need him for the next World Cup, England, anyway. I'll lead off if that's cool with everyone. My pick of the week this week is Beyond Good and Evil HD. Re-released this week for the Xbox 360 and coming later for PlayStation 3 users around the world. It's great to see. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Is that the game where the girl took pictures?
Yes.
That was a GameCube game.
Yeah. And
she was a photographer or whatever?
Yeah, kind of like an investigative journalist trying to... You know.
Not like Fatal Frame, but yeah. Oh, really?
Exactly. Yeah. No. It's one of my favorite games. A little bit kind of different take on the whole adventure realm, and I'm glad to see it's getting a wider release, and hopefully it'll get played many, many times by different people and get the true respect that it really deserves.
Well, that game was always really critically acclaimed. I don't know why it didn't do better, but I want to address the critical acclaim. I think the game's a bit overrated if you listen to some people. The gameplay is basically just a ripoff of all the 3D Zelda games that came out at around the same time, but with a really, really annoying, poorly implemented stealth game aspect that just...
Well, I mean, it's not trying to be like Metal Gear or anything. But,
yeah, but
you know,
but if you're going to be sneaky, you should be at least aspire to hit the same level as Metal Gear 1.
It's essentially, it was made as, it's like a video game for people who don't normally play video games. You know, it's basically kind of just dumbed down and simple. But, you know, I really liked it. It just,
I'm gonna
everything
have to check.
That, you know, just the style and gameplay, it was just a really fun experience.
I'm going to have to check it out because I always wanted to play that game when it was on GameCube. Because I had a GameCube back in the day. I actually still have my GameCube. The only reason I have it is for Resident Evil 4. You know, I had heard the same thing about it being a really cool game. And I wonder when you say that when Scott Max there was talking about how he thinks it might be a little overrated, I wonder if it's going to, since it's been released on Xbox and the PSN now, that it's going to be one of these things with the nostalgia glasses where it might even get where it's like, oh, this is just so amazing. And, you know, because people thought of it.
Yeah. So fondly.
So fondly back then. And I don't know. It's always very interesting about that, but yeah, that's cool. I'll have to check that out. How much is it on the systems?
I'm not entirely sure, but if I had to guess, it would probably be 1,200 Microsoft points.
Oh, banana money.
The banana dollars.
Yeah, exactly.
I have both, but I've been playing more my PS3 lately because I like my games to come on one disc.
Yeah, that was one of the things that kind of put me off getting the Resident Evil 5, like the special fancy edition, is that so the Xbox version came with like this download token for all the stuff, and the Resident Evil 5 for the PS3 came, everything, you know, was on the Blu-ray disc, and like that's fantastic.
Well, it's like when I bought Dead Space 2, you not only get, because I bought it for PS3, and you not only get the game, but you also get the actual Wii game.
Wow.
So, yeah, you get the Wii game, and then like a whole bunch of other crap that is downloadable on it, so... And, you know, because I had a friend of mine, he's like, oh, we got to play the multiplayer. I'm like, but he bought it for Xbox. And, you know, it's like, well, how was that to play up to that one point? And then it says, insert disc 2.
Like, you know what, guys? No one seemed to mind swapping discs. None of the Sony fans seemed to mind swapping discs on the PlayStation 1 days. And to bust out my old man rant... You guys did not play FMV adventure games on PC in the late 90s. You don't know what disc swapping is.
True. True.
True. But but that was because the technology was limited at that time. The technology's not limited now. And see, I still contend Microsoft screwed up by, okay, maybe HD didn't win the format war, but they should have kept that for their games. Because you're going to be able to put so much more information on it. Because I'll be honest with you, at the PS3, they haven't even really tapped into the market yet, and those games look amazing now.
I mean, anybody else think that Blu-ray is a stupid name for HD? When you know they could have just won the format war and just taken the HD name and just, you know, makes sense.
I wonder why they called it Blu-ray, to be honest with you. Was it because, well, didn't the disc used to be blue on the back?
Yeah, discs are blue, but, like, CD-ROMs are blue half the time.
Yeah, exactly. That doesn't make them DVDs or you know, HD DVDs. Just, they could have won the format war and just bought the rights to the name. Just HD is just, it makes sense. That's what it is, you know? It's not a Blu-ray. I mean, it is a Blu-ray, but it's, you know, it's HD.
Or not.
Anyways,
have a
people don't know what
have a child name.
Like, Blu-ray sounds like either something from Australia that will kill you, or possibly a lame supervillain who might also be from Australia and kill you.
Or like from like some 1930s serial cartoon where it's like, you know, some space hero is like, I'm gonna hit you with my Blu-ray. No.
The powers of Google have prevailed once again. I have I now know why it is called Blu-ray.
Why is that?
Because it is encoded with a blue-violet laser optical ray.
Why is it blue-violet ray, though?
I don't know. Well, why can't they add that last E to the word blue?
It's edgier when you chop off or change the letters, you know?
Yeah, they don't, do they? Let me take a look. Oh, yeah. I never really noticed that. I'm looking at one of my Blu-ray movies. I'm like, I never noticed that it was BLU. I don't know. Oh, you learn something every day.
It's there you go. That could be your pick of the week. Beyond Good and Evil HD 800 Microsoft Banana Ports.
Oh,
so
that's actually pretty good.
It's quite reasonable for a full length game. And I'm not a viral marketer.
Hey, you know what? We're totally willing to be viral marketers. If you're listening, you would not have to pay us much.
Exactly. Get in contact with us. You can reach us at Scott's blog where these podcasts are posted. Yes.
Just get in touch. That's Doug, I'll cut you in for like 20%.
Exactly. We'll be here.
All right, next pick of the week. You got something, Neo, or should I go?
You go ahead. I'm narrowing it down.
I'm going to give it to a game that isn't out yet at time of recording, but will be by the time the episode drops. Dragon Age 2.
Yeah.
I've played the demo like 3 times now. Just to get a feel for how all the classes got changed around. I'm liking the feel. Like, a lot of people are bitching about the art style and the fact that the combat actually is fast now. They've definitely adopted a much more action movie tone, which is...
Let me get this straight. People that play games are bitching about the new game of a game that they played before.
Yeah, I know. Shocking.
I think this could be the first time in recorded history that's happened.
I've never heard of this before.
This is a distinct and strange phenomena.
And let me guess, all the things that they improved are all the things that people were complaining about in the first game. Oh my god, this is probably...
Of course.
Yes.
Was it just me, or did you feel that that game had a distinct kind of... Mass Effect was successful, so we should try and make this game a little bit more like Mass Effect kind of feel.
I'm mixed on the dialogue wheel thing. Like, I like that it's got the little indicator now that says, oh, that gives you a little symbol. It's like, this is sarcastic. This is you being diplomatic. If you figure out what the symbols mean. As opposed to Mass Effect, where you just sort of had like this little one-word summary of what you were going to say, and you sort of had to guess.
Yeah, and then, you know, you had the certain dialogue options that were, you know, highlighted in blue for good and to be a paragon and stuff.
What is it? Marvel Ultimate Alliance 2 had that, where you would have people where they interact, and it'd be like, would you like a – and then you'd say something. It'd be like, diplomatic, you know, aggressive.
Yeah, exactly.
It's weird.
Yeah.
I just want to play the game and blow crap up.
Pretty much.
I'm gonna miss being able to scroll through a whole list with all the dialogue options, because I'm the guy who always chooses the funniest one.
Right.
And the switch to the wheel probably means we'll see less of the options that pop up that are related to your skills. Like, I know in Dragon Age 1 there were a lot of options that were based on, like, if you had high perception or really good cunning, you got more dialogue options. And I don't think we're going to see that come back as much for 2.
Why am I pre-ordering this game when they're just going to release it next year as an Ultimate Edition with all the DLC bundled together? Why am I doing this?
Because you want it now.
Fair.
And what's really weird is I'm buying it the day of, but I know that I'm going to wait a year for Elder Scrolls 5.
Is it going to really take that? I thought it was coming out this
year. No, it's coming out at the end of the year, but I'm going to wait a year after that and get the Ultimate Edition of Elder Scrolls 5. I think I want it with all the extra stuff. Plus, it'll give Bethesda a chance to fix the one big annoying thing they do in all their games.
I really hope this one, they don't have the monsters, you know, level up with you. Because that was, how can I put this?
Balls.
Yeah, it was just a load of shit.
Based on interviews, it's going to be closer to the way Fallout worked, where, you know, there's a range that they'll spawn in. So
right. That's, I don't have a problem with that, but like, you never feel like you're actually getting stronger when the guys are, you know, leveling up with you. It's just,
well,
like, why am I playing?
Oblivion, you couldn't even fight more than two guys at once, ever.
Yeah, oh, you're toast.
You're toast. Why did I play 100 hours of Oblivion when all I seem to do about it is complain?
And just run through the wilderness.
Just run through the woods, poking at caves.
Pretty much.
Getting attacked by mountain lions.
Wolves, if you're lucky.
Wolves, if you were lucky to be, no. And there were like four kinds of wolves for some reason.
Yeah.
Like regular wolf, and then like gray wolf,
yeah,
and
like
super
dark wolf. Yeah.
Dark wolf and dark evil
yeah,
wolf.
Something like that. I think it was like timber wolves and then winter wolves. I'm like, who cares?
That's the one thing I don't like about games like that. It's the leveling up crap sometimes. It's just, it can be a little tedious. And the games are cool, but it's just, man, it's like, oh crap, I gotta kill another wolf again. Oh, that only got me 1 point now because I'm now level 40 instead of 39. So it's like, oh, really?
Oh man, try playing the Final Fantasy games.
I can't do them anymore.
Grind.
I can't do those things anymore either. I used to play them. I like those games. It's like, even I understand why people play like WoW and all that. I mean, I think it's cool. I've seen people play it and known people that have, and it looks really cool, but it's just such a grind, and it's like sometimes I don't have 8 hours a day to devote to this thing. And
exactly. It's like listening to Yes albums, you know? You just get halfway through Tales of the Topographic Oceans. You're like, why the hell am I doing this to myself? Like, I could be enjoying, you know, having a good time.
It's like, oh crap, here comes the third guitar solo. This will be another 2 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I've never heard this before. That's good. And anyways, I'm sorry, I digress.
Yeah. All right, Neo, down to you.
All right, I'd probably say a pick, actually something that I bought this week. I know it's been a little long time. It's been a while, and I, for whatever reason, I just didn't buy this album when it came out, and it's surprising because I'm a huge fan of this group, is the Tron Legacy soundtrack by Daft Punk.
Nice.
Huge Daft Punk fan, and I haven't even seen the movie, but I heard the album, and I had a friend of mine that gave me a copy of it, and I finally just bought it. And you know, I would definitely, you know, anybody that's into that type of music, or even people that aren't. I mean, I think it's I think they're one of those groups where, with the whole kind of house dance music genre, they're one of those big crossover groups, and it's pretty amazing. And I heard it really fits the movie pretty well. Like I stated, I hadn't seen the movie. I heard it's kind of me.
It's as good as the first one.
Yeah, Rich, the first one was me. I don't know. The first one was viewed with nostalgia glasses. It's like, oh, it's, people thought it was like some magnum opus about the man machine, you know, debate. And it's like, well, if you wanted that, watch The Matrix. You know, they already did that a few years ago, so. Except for that, don't watch that third one.
Well, actually, listening to a bunch of people, particularly the Spoonie, his rant on the movie, what everyone seems to have wanted from the sequel was what they did in Reboot, which is now on DVD.
Oh.
Fuck yeah.
Great show. I have not seen the film, but the soundtrack is solid. Daft Punk or, you know, like the standard bearers for house music right now. I mean, I can't even think of another house group, really.
Well, I could think of some, but not to the effect that they are. I mean, because these are the same people.
Basement
that,
Jacks.
Yeah, I mean, if people, what was it last year that Kanye West did that song Stronger? I mean, that was a Daft Punk song that he redid, and so. Like I said, they're one of those groups that they cross all genres when it comes to people liking them, and, you know, people being influenced by them. And, cause I mean, even that video that he had, it was kind of like, what it was like in Interstellar 555, which was when they went through the, through the factory. I hadn't seen Interstellar in so long. I have it too, but anyways, that's my pick of the week. Definitely check that out. And I know it's a few months old, but
good hey, stuff.
Sometimes,
hey, it's
sometimes
it's,
you forget.
Yeah, exactly. And just in the news earlier this week, the Tron Legacy reconfigured remix album coming out later this spring, April 5th.
Yeah, I am a little disappointed, though, that in the States we just got the 22 songs. I know that there's like about 28 songs for the international folks, and I don't know why Disney you would do that. I really don't. I was tempted on trying to get the import, but it was like about $50-$60.
Harsh.
Yeah, you can just download them, I'm sure. Legally. Yeah.
This is one of those moments where you go, how do I set up a British iTunes account?
Yeah,
pretty exactly. much. Yeah, and I try not to do that stuff because you start having too many of these accounts, you start getting confused.
Yeah.
And it's like people that create the PSN and Xbox Live accounts for Japan just to play demos. It's like, I have a hard enough time being on just the one that I have in America.
Yeah. So. Yeah, exactly. Just gotta, keep it as basic as possible at all times.
Yeah. So, but yeah, definitely check it out. So.
For sure.
All right.
Do it or die.
Not threatening at all.
No, not at all.
Okay, so getting into our main topic, which is another Battle of the Bands episode. If you missed the early one, I think it was episode 8. Check that out.
What was your first Battle of
the Bands? It was Beatles versus Stones. It's one of those ones that just goes around the internet forever. We figured we'd add something to it.
Go Stones.
Yeah, we basically said Stones rule.
Yeah.
Up until like maybe the mid 80s, yeah. I mean,
basically till they went disco.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause they went to one of those, they went to that new, weird new age type of stuff that was happening. What in the 80s, mid 80s, yeah. A lot of those groups kind of went that route. So
needs more synthesizers. No, let's not forget what made us great.
Five strings and a lot of jack.
Yeah, pretty much. That pretty much sums it up nicely. But yes. Who Led Zeppelin?
I just want to say that I picked these bands because they are both heavy blues inspired British bands from the same era that have self deprecating names. That's basically the only reason we are having this debate.
I always see The Who as the band that if the Rolling Stones really didn't have Jagger as the lead singer, I think that's how the Stones would have went more towards what The Who actually did. But maybe a little bit harder, not necessarily as almost silly that the Stones got sometimes. So, but go on, I'm sorry.
No. That's an excellent opening statement.
What's that?
What you just said.
On
it, my thoughts on these two bands, at least to start, is that if you ask me what my favorite band on the face of the earth is, depending on what day of the week it is, I will say either The Who or Led Zeppelin. It's very tight in my mind, and I'll get into some of the specifics, but they're just both great acts and just incredible, hold up incredibly well, even, 40 years later.
Yeah, and the way that I perceive them, Led Zeppelin always struck me as a band that was really, they were really serious, they took themselves really seriously, and they would do kind of, like the big, epic numbers, but never so much, trying to make one big kind of unified statement like The Who did, with Tommy or Quadrophenia or anything like that. But it was always kind of just like, on a smaller scale, and they would always kind of, get very serious about all these things and, kind of just leave the antics, for off the stage, and they would live kind of a very, what's kind of a rough lifestyle, but, you know, never really in the same way that I think the Rolling Stones did, who just took it to a whole nother level. But The Who always kind of struck me as a little bit more kind of they seem to have a lot more fun with their music, you know. And then Zeppelin were always kind of just, you know, very solemn and stone faced, and that would always, you know, take their work very, very seriously. And I think that has a lot to do with, you know, the kind of perception that both bands have left behind.
Well, I think I think that's probably a fair comparison. The fact when it comes to Zeppelin is they were so technical, and I mm-hmm. think that's why it almost seemed like they were a little serious, because if you really think about it, some of their songs, they weren't very serious in them. If you listen,
they wrote a lot of songs about hobbits.
Yeah, well, exactly. Battle of Evermore, you know, it's very fantasy based.
Well, they are the ones that pretty much started wizard metal, you know, yeah. Which came out of that is, you know, like bands like what, probably one of the most well known, Dragon Force and Hammerfall and. You know, and I kind of like listening to that music at times. I'm a big metal fan, but it's, you know, I love, like, you know, the classics, the Big Four and everything like that. But the wizard metal stuff is great because it's so positive. And it is always funny hearing, you know, I'm coming down the mountain, wings of light, you know, some crazy friggin' guitar solo. But, yeah, I think it is, back to your point, though, I think it is a fair comparison to say that The Who really wanted to just kind of shake things up, not only with their music, but with their performances. And they were very animated, and, you know, Pete Townsend, I mean, he destroyed guitars. And, of course, Keith Moon was, you know, just out of his mind.
Right.
And, you know, that's pretty much what set those bands apart. But if you really look at it, in some ways, just looking on the surface, besides the blues influence, they look very similar just in their, you know, in the group, because you have the blonde kind of pretty boy singer. Now, Townsend and Jimmy Page, two opposite ends of the spectrum, but Jimmy Page is high on heroin all the time. So I think that's probably part of his thing. But then you have just incredibly gifted and technical drummers who were just, you know, you knew who they were just by the sound that they were making, and the really quiet and reserved, you know, technical bassist that, you know, basically that accompanied both the drummers great. I mean, that's always the big thing that I see with these two bands is the rhythm section outside of just, you know, the singing and the guitar. The rhythm sections are just so tight and are just so distinct. And, you know, but, you know, this will be an interesting conversation, though, that we're going to have.
All right. So getting into sort of the overall sounds and strengths and weaknesses of each is that The Who seem to have less of a solid identity. Like, the first few albums are just sort of straight out modish jangliness. They move into, you know, and then they keep switching it up. Like, they move into harder rock and R&B, and then, you know, their live stuff is basically the dawn of punk in so many ways. And then the last stuff, and then at the end, they get a lot more poppy again. And obviously that sort of variety shows how well they could work as songwriters, but isn't quite so unified. Like, you play something off something like My Generation or Sell Out, and you put that up against something later like Live at Leeds or Quadrophenia, and they're completely, like, it's almost like completely different bands. Contrast that with Zeppelin, who, you know, they started off so strong. Zep 1 is probably one of the most fun albums to listen to. And it really, and they kept that sound together all through till, you know, the end, till they broke up.
Not necessarily, because if you really think about it, from about Physical Graffiti on, they started to go into a lot different, you know, a lot of their songs, they started experimenting with a lot of different sounds. I mean, you have, like, I'm a Step fan, but one of the most overrated songs to me is Kashmir. And, you know, because it's got that kind of Middle Eastern sound to it. And, you know, you have that. You have, like, Fool in the Rain, which is kind of like one of those songs where it was a precursor to a lot of the ska-influenced stuff that was started coming in through, like, the 80s and 90s. You know, that kind of reggae-infused type of sound. So saying that, Led Zeppelin 1 is the same as, what was the last album? Into the Outdoor?
Coda, if you count Coda.
No, Coda was other, it was like tracks.
Yeah, that was tracks.
It
was, the last real album would have been, Presence. No, it is In Through the Outdoor.
Yeah, it is through the, and if you listen to In Through the Outdoor, you can see where they were going, and that album was not as hard as Led Zeppelin 1. And, So I think they're similar in that spec. I do agree with you. I think that the Who really changed their sound from their debut album all the way to the end of the 70s. They did sound a lot different, and you know, but I don't think you can say that Zeppelin just kind of stayed the same all throughout their career, because they did show that they were starting to branch out. I mean,
yeah,
like we mentioned the Battle of Evermore. I mean, you imagine being in, what was it, like the early 70s and going from Led Zeppelin 3 to buying 4, and then it's what, Black Dog? I think the track's like Black Dog, Rock and Roll.
Black Dog was on 3.
No, Black Dog's on 4.
No, it's on 3.
It's on 4.
Totally looking, man.
It's the first track on 4.
Okay, right. No, No, it's like, Immigrant Song is the one song I like on 3.
Three was really kind of an interesting record, because it was mostly, aside from, I think, Immigrant Song and Celebration Day, it was mostly just kind of all acoustic, which was really interesting, because, you know, they kind of made them name for themselves with their, you know, electric, Jimmy Page's electric guitar wizardry, and they kind of just, you know, scale it all back, and they, you know, just get out the acoustic guitars and the mandolins and things like that, and it's much more of a kind of a rootsy sound. So that was their first kind of, you know, this is what we're going to do that's going to be really different kind of album, until they, you know, started getting into more of the stuff that was built around synthesizers and keyboards and whatnot.
Yeah, because you go from 2, which is basically just, you know, I think 2 is the influence of a lot of the hard rock and heavy metal that we have now. I mean, the riff works on most of those songs on Led Zeppelin 2 are just so hard and just so in your face. And yeah, like you said, you go from to Led Zeppelin 3, where the Immigrant Song is an awesome song, and then all of a sudden you got a bunch of songs that are acoustical.
It's them sitting around the campfire getting their kumbaya's out.
Exactly.
Well, it's always amazing to me, and I don't know as much when it comes to the Who, when it came to their recording process, but I know with Led Zeppelin, I mean, a lot of those albums were done in the span of like 2 or 3 weeks, where they would just go off in, like, in the English countryside, and they'd lock themselves in a house and just sit there and write and record. And I think that was kind of you know, the reason why we do sometimes have these weird songs on there, because they're not only probably just sitting there jamming out, but, you know, of course, getting drunk and getting high and stuff. So
exactly. And it's really it's just so jarring to think about the fact that Led Zeppelin 1 and 2 were released in the same calendar year. And now, you know, everything is just so much more kind of slowed down the process. You know, some artists take, you know, 2, 3, 4, even 5 years between albums. You know, it just, the entire recording process is just so different. I remember the when The Who came out with their latest album that they went on the world tour for about 3 years supporting. It was like their first album since the 80s, you know, and I realize that's kind of a different beast, just because, you know, half the band, the original band, is dead at that point. But, you know, it's just so different, you know, the whole attitude towards, you know, recording from when they were early on in their career, you know, and in the later days, you know, just how much time it takes to hone their material and get it down to the point where they feel they're satisfied with it.
Yeah, no, and that's a good point, because it is one of those things where it's funny that, you know, we talk about how, you know, Led Zeppelin, you know, one in, like you stated, one and two open, you know, they were released in pretty much the same calendar year, and now it takes a lot longer depending on no matter what genre it is. But it's funny because Led Zeppelin kind of changed the way that music and how these bands are, because without them, you wouldn't really have the rock star life, because these guys didn't get paid back in those. I mean, Led Zeppelin, outside of their music, they changed the formula from when, you know, most of these bands would make their money off of selling albums. They never really made anything off of touring. And, you know, they had like that gangster, manager that they had. And, you know, he basically demanded like 90% of the take on these things. And, you know, that's pretty much kind of the standard now when it comes to a band. It's like you go out, they make more money touring than they do actually releasing, releasing albums. And it's funny that, you know, that's kind of the way it is now. So
come see us, come buy our shirt.
Yeah. I mean, they started all of that. I mean, yeah. they were like, what, the first group to have their own plane and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And I mean, in the end, they changed it, not only with their influence of their music, but kind of how the innards of the industry, works and the business of it. And, you know, but the Who did it too. I mean, the Who, you know, I believe the Who and the, and Zeppelin are kind of intertwined, because they both kind of knew each other, right? I mean, didn't the guys play with each other before really Zeppelin got together? I'm thinking they did. I think it was, I don't know. I might be wrong, but I think they were, you know, kind of doing the same type of clubs and all that in, you know, in London and England around there. So
yeah, well,
when both bands were kind of start, you know, late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah,
then.
Well,
so.
Yeah, the London scene was a pretty tight place back then. I mean, you know, there were a lot of guys, there were a lot of American artists who, you know, went to London just to be part of that. Same way, you know, people traveled to New York and Montreal and all these other places just for the scene alone.
Yeah, that's where that scene is where Hendrix got really big. I mean, he got big over there, and then he, you know, people kind of discovered him over here. You know, but he was all in that scene too. So, yeah, it's interesting, and I'd say that out of that, because I think always the one thing that you see about between these two bands is. There's a lot of similarities, but there, you know, there are some differences where I think the Who were actually more successful in England than the U.S., where Zeppelin weren't very popular in England. They were more of a U.S. band. I mean, they got big because of the U.S.
That's a great point, and something that's always been kind of interesting to me is the fact that, you know, the British people kind of want music that's, you know, made for them, you know, that's addressing them. I mean, that's half the reason that, you know, Britpop got so big in the 90s, and it was Oasis, and it was Blur, and it was Pulp, and Suede, and they were just talking about, you know, discussing things through songs that were just quintessentially British, and, you know, really just kind of sparked like a new interest in a new generation. And the Who were exactly like that. You know, they were just very British in their approach to stuff, like the Who Sell Out, which is kind of like a really had a lot of kind of like typical, you know, British dry humor towards advertising. And
well,
yeah.
That, you know, and I don't think many Americans could relate to, you know, offshore pirate radio broadcasts.
Exactly. And, you know, the Kinks are a lot like the Who in the fact that, you know, they would just songs and whole albums just, you know, dedicated to, you know, being British and you know, the kind of life that comes along with doing like that. So I think that's a great point right there.
Yeah, I mean the thing is you know, they're both kind of blues influenced, but you hear, especially as Zeppelin does, you know, move on in their career, the blues is still that basis. I mean, you do get these albums where they do start to experiment in different ways of fan, but you still will have that song, that blues song on an album. I mean, they always have like kind of a throwback to a Led Zeppelin 1 song because that's what they wanted to play. And, you know, Jimmy Page was heavily influenced as a guitar player with American blues. And that's probably why it did so well. That's why they did so well in the U.S. because, I mean, I think really their success mainly came from the U.S. when they were touring. And of course, you know, as throughout the years, Zeppelin has become just a worldwide band. I mean, I think they're probably one of the most influential bands ever because of the, not only on the business side, but if you really look at it, influencing different genres and stuff. And when I was originally asked to be on this show, when I had heard The Who versus Zeppelin, I thought a Versus thing. I was like, I don't know how you could actually sit there and have some, you know, like that, because I think the bands are, I think on further influences, I think it's kind of apples and oranges to an extent.
Yeah, and it was kind of like what Scott was saying earlier, and the Led Zeppelin has been about the blues since day one. I mean, Jimmy Page was recruited out of John Mayall's Blues Breakers, and that's, you know, pretty much what he has done for, you know, since he's very young to present day. And The Who were a lot more kind of mod influenced in their approach, you know, and that, I think, you know, kind of set the two, you know, kind of compasses for each band's path, you know, or early on. I mean, you know, like we were talking about earlier, you know, the Who obviously tried to mix it up as much as they could throughout the course of their career. But, you know, despite the different, you know, approaches to Led Zeppelin albums, you know, they had the one kind of underlying influence that was guiding them kind of all the way through.
Yeah, because, I mean, they, in essence, they really helped forge, they really kind of created the hard rock scene. And them, along with Sabbath, really kind of created heavy metal as we know it today. And, you know, where The Who, I think they don't get enough credit, like you had stated earlier, that their influence on the punk scene, especially with, you know, the punk scene really coming out of Britain, out of the late 70s and stuff, I don't know why they don't get more credit for that, to be honest with you. That was an interesting point that you brought up. But I think it's because sometimes with it, we think of like Tommy and all that, and, you know, a lot different than, some of the earlier stuff.
Well, so the thing about The Who is that they sort of have three different live acts. Like they have their nightclub sort of, they have their nightclub small concert hall act, which was, you know, let's shout at the audience and break our shit and go nuts. Yeah. And then that's where they started the punk rock stuff. Like, I think my favorite line about how you quantify punk rock, it's these two guys walking along and one of them knocks over a garbage can. It says, that's punk rock. And then the other guy kicks over the next garbage can. Was that punk rock? No, you're just a conformist.
Yeah, exactly.
Like these guys did a lot of things, and then the other two aspects of Who live shows are the opera house and large seating concert halls that you see things like where they do the entirety of Tommy or all of Quadrophenia. It's very much, it's like they're performing opera, obviously. And then there's the concert stuff, which is Who's Neck. The stadium stuff. The Coliseum acts, which are like obviously, Who's Next is just, it's a stadium album, and it's a great arena rock right there.
Yeah, Rich, you know, and with that, you know, Zeppelin are kind of the, you know, the creators of this, that kind of stadium type of act. I mean, they're, especially from about three on, their albums are more kind of the stadium rock type of thing. But in the same way, in the same vein too, you can see them go back. You could see those songs being done in more of a club thing, but from, you know, probably from like about 1972 on, it's like you were not seeing Zeppelin was just going to be playing in big arenas and big stadiums, and especially in the United States. I don't think they really did any small shows in the U.S. Once they really started hitting it big, I don't think they did at all. But you know, I think that was the difference between the two scenes with the U.S. and Britain. I mean, Britain always. It seemed like the club scene and the, you know, the small halls and stuff was a bigger thing, and probably because of the way the two countries are. I mean, they you know, there's not that many huge stadiums in Britain, where in the United States, that's all you had. You had more stadiums in these cities than you did actual small venues outside of probably New York, Chicago, and L.A. And it's a very interesting comparison, and it's been a very interesting look at you know, it's like when I was approached with this, you know, a couple weeks ago, I had been thinking about it, and I had been doing some you know, some catch up between the two bands, and like I had stated I didn't think there was too much of a, I thought it was apples and oranges to an extent, and it is in a lot of ways, but the kind of the way that they kind of followed each other together, but yet separately throughout their careers through the '70s is very, you know, very interesting. So
one thing I kind of want to get into, and this is where I come down a little hard on Zeppelin, is that lyrically, I think the Who are much stronger. It's very angry, cynical, very angry, cynical young men, you know, don't trust anyone over 30. But then where it gets interesting is when they get to be over 30, it turns very introspective, and they're still mad, but they're mad at themselves for not doing better by things.
It's kind of like the...
Or becoming what they were talking about years ago.
Exactly. You know, like, what have we done with our lives up to this point? It's very kind of, you know, just like the quintessentially British kind of, you know, like, I'm going to cry on the inside, but, you know, I'm going to have a stiff upper lip and, you know, not really show anybody. And, you know, it's kind of like one of those songs, like, you know, it sounds like kind of upbeat and happy, but unless you're really listening closely to the lyrics, you'd never be able to tell. It's, you know, kind of a bit of a downer. It's almost like when Reagan was born in the USA is his campaign anthem.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's I think, you know, once again, it's the fact that they are kind of the forerunners of the punk scene, because you know, when I was growing up, I was big into a lot of punk music, and that's always been the issue with the punk scene. It's like, okay, don't trust anything, don't trust authority, don't trust people with money. But once these guys start to get successful and they start to get money, it's all of a sudden they're what they don't want to be, and then they just become self-destructive, and you know, they have issues with it, and then they, you know, they kind of alienate their fans because of that. So you know, I would say that probably I could agree with you about the lyrical thing, because it depends what you want music to do, because music can be introspective, it can be social commentary, it can be just about anything that you want. And I think if you're looking for something where, okay, especially in the later, you know, the later part of the 70s with the Who, yeah, it is going to be more of more social commentary and more introspective, where Zeppelin, it's just, you know, this woman did me wrong, or, you know, like we stated with Battle Evermore and some of these other songs where they start to just go into the whole witches and warlocks thing, mainly because of Jimmy Page and, you know, his whole kind of thing that he loved about black magic and all that. So it's like,
right.
I think that that's a fair complaint, but it also comes down to what you're looking for. And I think as true music listeners, and I found it with myself, you know, there are different points in my life where I want stuff that's more self-biographical or introspective. And then, you know, like I stated earlier, sometimes I just like listening to some wizard metal where it's just, you know, it's fast tempos, it's silly stuff, and it just makes you feel good.
Yeah.
And I think that that's where it's where you want. And I think Zeppelin, outside of a few songs, they usually the things kind of make you feel real kind of good, or they kind of get you not necessarily enraged, but kind of upbeat, where the Who are just like some of the songs, they can just get you downright down and kind of pissed off.
Yeah, no, and it's like, and I'm not to slay it too much complaining about Zeppelin. Like when I want to rock out, I will just listen to Zep 1 all the way through. Yeah. But I there's a lot of songs that just seem to boil down to really amazing guitar riff, baby, 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 chorus, bunch of really weird images we came up while we were stoned, Tolkien reference, play out.
Yeah, and one of the things that you just touched upon kind of puts me off of Zeppelin sometimes, that the Who don't have working against them, is like on Whole Lot of Love, like, half the song is just Robert Plant just going, just like, you know, kind of just making sound with his voice. And I get, you know, it's part of the job, you know, of the singer to kind of, you know, create something that the guitarist can play off of. But it just feels to me like sometimes like he's just kind of just doing it for no reason. It just turns out to be just, it's nothing. Like it adds nothing. It's just,
well, I think this is not to be, you know, Zeppelin apologist or anything like this, but I think if you take it's like I stated earlier, if you go musician by musician, I think Entwistle and John Paul Jones very, very close. Jimmy Page and Townsend, I think Jimmy Page a little bit more so, because I believe that Jimmy Page is one of the most underrated guitarists out there. I think when people talk about guitarists, he's never in, especially like the top five. I mean, the top is always Hendrix. It doesn't matter. One never changes because of just what he was able to do and how he did it. But I think when you go from two to five, you know, Page is never put in there, which always irritates me. Keith Moon, John Bonham.
Yeah.
I mean,
too close to call.
Honestly, too close to call. It's a tie for two for greatest drummer of all time.
What, no Ringo?
No. Ringo's way down there. Ringo's down there. One is, of course, Neil Peart.
Let's not talk Rush.
Yeah, why do you hate on Rush, man? You're Canadian.
Hey, watch out what you say about Rush. They'll kick us off CanadianPodcast.com.
It's true. It's true.
And Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, how the Rush is not in there when I've seen some of this other crap that you have in there, please, really. But they're to get, you know, they're very similar, Bonham and Keith Moon. But I think the difference that you have is when you have Roger Daltrey and you have Robert Plant. Robert Plant, I don't think really could play an instrument. I think Daltrey plays some guitar. Didn't he a couple times play some guitar?
He ends up doing rhythm on a few things, or like if they brought in like some of the odder instruments, he did those.
I think they can both play guitar, harmonica.
Oh yeah, harmonica.
Yeah, that's right. They can play. Yeah, I don't know why I didn't think that. But when I think when it comes to the influences of the lyrics that they write, because I mean, I believe most of the lyrics for Led Zeppelin is mostly Page, Plant, and John Paul Jones, I believe. And most of the stuff with the Who is going to be Daltrey and probably Townsend. that I think talent Daltrey has just got a little bit. I think he's a little bit deeper, and I think it's because, like you stated earlier, they come from that mod scene and that whole kind of beatnik, you know, spoken word type of scene that was going on in the 60s and stuff. So where, you know, Robert Plant was kind of added to Zeppelin because he was, what, friends with Bonham. And I mean, he can wail, or he used to be able to wail before he got to be about the size of a whale. I would agree with that. I mean,
yeah.
I think that's a good thing. And, you know, to an extent, I think Zeppelin, they never, what I like about it is they never tried to be social commentary band, but
right.
Didn't do it very well. I hate that when people artists try to be about social commentary, but yet they don't do it very well, or it's just kind of, they're just doing it to,
for the attention.
Neil Young, let's impeach the president.
Well, no, my biggest example, Green. It's like,
what about Justin Bieber? It's like, I don't know much about politics, but what they have in Korea isn't good.
I'm talking more of the music, but
right.
it's just
American
like,
idiot.
Yeah, I mean, I loved Green Day. I mean, their old stuff I love, and I hate saying that. I hate being the old, the old stuff is always better, but
sometimes
their
it's
newer
true.
Album, their newest album was okay, what, 21st Century Breakdown. It was more of a thing, but yeah, American Idiot, I'm like, really? I mean, you were the punk band that was never social commentary. You were just always about getting stoned and drunk.
Yeah, kind of just like a bunch of goofy, you know, suburban kids.
Yeah, exactly. So,
yeah.
But, yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, I think that that's a fair comparison between the two bands.
If I could just say one thing on
sure.
behalf of John Paul Jones, I think he's very kind of underrated in terms of, you know, he can do like a whole lot. I mean, you know, he's mostly known as being the bass player in Led Zeppelin, but he's also very good on the mandolin, and there's nothing with keys that exists that he can't play. I mean, you know, one of my favorite tracks that I think he was the cornerstone on for Led Zeppelin was No Quarter, you know, playing the
yes.
synthesizer on that. And it just such a creepy kind of a dark tune, you know, and just, I just love the playing on that. And he's a very skilled pianist, and, you know, he can play the keyboards very well, synthesizers, all that kind of stuff. So he may not be as good like as a technical pure bass player as John Entwistle. I think he might, you know, have a little bit more in terms of overall, you know, kind of musical talent and skill, you know, even though he's not as good at just playing that one particular instrument.
Getting into John Entwistle is he did write, he was sort of like George Harrison for the Beatles in that he got like, you know, two songs on every album or something. And they're usually pretty solid tunes, but he also played horns on a few tracks, and what's interesting about him is he was one of the first, like, rock bassists to get a solo.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is, when you think about it, it's like, it's sort of crazy in my mind that it took that long for bass solos to happen.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, because you have to kind of think about it when, you know, This is the late 60s, early 70s. The electric guitar didn't really even come out till like what, the late 50s.
It was invented in 1933.
Was it? But it didn't really get popularized until like the 50s or so, wasn't it? I mean,
it had already made its mark in jazz music by the 40s, but jazz music is weird that way.
Yeah, so I think when it came to the kind of the rock side, people were really finding out what they could do with the guitar because it just wasn't the regular three keys, you know, and more or less as a rhythm part of the rhythm section. You know, the guitar kind of took the forefront in the 60s and 70s with these groups, you know, and players like Hendrix and Page and Townsend and all these guys where I think it, where it does kind of sound a lot of kind of odd that it took so long to get a bass solo. It doesn't necessarily seem all that odd, strange to me, but that might be just me. So.
Yeah. No, and thinking over it, it's like the influence on 60s rock from the folk side of things was probably a big part of that too.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, I mean, in all honesty, I think both these guys, Ant Wessel and Jean-Paul Jones, I mean, the fact that, okay, Ant Wessel was more a technical bassist than Jean-Paul Jones was, but the fact that they were multi-instrumental and they could not only incorporate a lot of those other instruments and use them as kind of incorporate them with the rhythm section, you know, as kind of a replacement to the bass is kind of amazing. So, and Jean-Paul Jones is on Them Crook Vultures now with Dave Grohl and the guy from
Queens of the Stone Age.
Stone Age. Yeah. Which is a pretty good band if you haven't heard them. So I definitely check it out.
All right.
Second pick of the week.
Getting into maybe away from the music a bit is the film careers of these bands. Zeppelin had two sort of concert movies, concert documentaries.
Well, Song Remains the Same is so self-indulgent, it's hard to watch.
Like, well, yeah. Hey, if anything, it gave us Spinal Tap for its existence.
Right. Like the whole sequence with them, I can't remember who it was, but I think it actually might be during No Quarter. John Paul Jones, like, riding the horse, like, in the white robes, just, like, through the countryside, just like, oh, my God, like, I don't care. Just show me the music. Like, I don't care. I'm not stoned right now. Just leave me alone.
Or I forget what song it is, but the one with Robert Plant and his naked kids by the river. And,
yeah, it's so weird.
It's just the way it starts off with their manager, who's, you know, a gangster.
Yeah.
And it starts off with that whole like chase sequence and stuff. It's just, it's very bizarre. But yeah, go ahead.
And then there was the other DVD that was just called Led Zeppelin, which was a bunch of random footage sort of smashed together.
Oh right, yeah, from their U.S. tours. Is that the one? It's like a desert.
Yeah,
cover
the cover's like the desert, and it's like a bunch of. Like, half of it's, like, bootleg footage from, like, their Royal Albert Hall shows. Like these a bunch of live shows from the 70s. And
I know it's completely unrelated, but Pink Floyd Live at Pompeii is awesome.
Yes.
Like, that is really, really cool. Like, they're playing Echoes and Set the Controls to the Heart of the Sun. Like, it's just, I don't know. That's neither here nor there.
But it is awesome. And
yeah, exactly. As far as concert videos go, that's one of my favorites.
That's how to do it right. Yeah, I agree with you with the other Zeppelin video. It was just, I hate sometimes when they try to show songs and then they just piece together random footage from different events because it looks weird.
It ends up looking weird.
Yeah, especially if it's a song that was a popular song early in their career and then you're showing like footage of them doing it when they were nothing, and then all of a sudden they're doing it like when they're something. It just looks really weird. And it's
like, oh, look at us, look how far we've came, you know? Yay.
Oh, it's just a cheap thing for fans. It's just a cheap way to, you know, just to get some money off it. It's like greatest hits albums. I'm not a fan of greatest hits albums.
Well,
and it's just always a cop out. I understand why they're done. It's to just get out of the stupidness to get the contract done with, because if you sign up for four albums and you've only done three and broken up, you still owe that last album or have to give all that money back.
Exactly. In terms of Zeppelin, Early Days, Later Days are not bad in terms of collections, but if you want the best of Led Zeppelin, buy the box set.
Yeah. You.
There's not one bad album in there.
I don't really – yeah, exactly. And I don't really think that – a lot of their albums, I mean, it's not like the Who had, you know, albums where, you know, every song kind of works together, but I just don't think that Zeppelin's albums were meant to be experienced just, you know, song by song. It's kind of like interlocking. They all kind of work together to make, you know, one kind of unified statement, you know, depending on which album it is, of course.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And then there's a few concert videos from DVDs from the Who. Two of them are recent, so they're just sort of old guys running around intercut with old footage and stuff. And then there was The Kids Are All Right, not to be confused with the recent lesbian movie.
The Oscar movie, but the lesbian?
Yeah, not to be confused with one of the lesbian movies of the Oscars this year.
Right.
sort of it's interviews and live shows. It's I don't know. I'm not a huge fan of concert DVDs, and less so when they keep jumping back and forth between, you know, interview footage and bits of different live things.
Exactly. If you're going to show the song, just show the song. Then, you know, get to the interview if you want to do that.
Yeah, but the whole thing of, like, you know, tell us about when you're in San Paulo in 74. And it's like, you know, and now they're much older, really disinterested, and they're, you know, trying to remember something they probably can't remember. And they're, because they were pretty either drunk or high or both at you know, during that time. So
that said, I will say the movie versions of both Tommy and Quadrophenia are just a lot of fun. Yeah. They're just all good.
Tommy being one of my more favorite ones. I think that's a really fun one.
I like the movie Tommy more, but I like the album Quadrophenia more. It's yes. That interesting.
Yeah, I agree with you. And Quadrophenia was not a huge success, was it?
It did okay. Like it was one of their number ones, I think.
Really? Okay. I didn't think it did as well commercially. I think it's one of those ones critically it's always looked at more so than, because I always kind of felt it was one of those albums that might have went over people's heads at that time. You know, it might have been ahead of its time.
Oh, no, it wasn't. It wasn't one of their number ones. It was a number two.
Yeah, I don't think it did as well. Yeah, it didn't do as well. I don't think the at that time. I think, yeah, since then.
One thing I did definitely want to touch on, and I'm kind of surprised we haven't got to it yet, is Live at Leeds is just tremendous in terms of, it's like the first I can think of anyway, like the first legendary live rock album. And it just, you know, and the Who were always kind of, you know, pretty put together, you know, in the studio, but it just, you never really, you know, unless you went to go and see them live, you could never really, you know, determine that they were just a completely different animal on the stage, you know, in front of a crowd. And that was like that is why, you know, people make live albums, just to, you know, and it's definitely kind of overkill now. Everyone has a live album, but that's one of the original reasons why that they decided to come out with it. Like, you know, here's this band that, you know, when you put them on stage in front of people, it just, like, this animal comes out of them, and it just completely fierce, and it just blew everybody away. It's like almost a completely different band.
Well, it was there. I think the thing with the Who is the unpredictability.
Yeah.
Of them. And they, I think that's what it really, I think that's what kind of set them apart. As great as Zeppelin was, I think probably by the time in the mid-70s, if you saw them in 74, they pretty much were going to do the same show in 76 as they did in 74, just with the newer stuff on it. You know, with The Who, it's one of those things where each city that they went into, it would be you could just see them jumbling up the set.
We're doing an 11-minute cut of 5:15.
Exactly, and you know, and I think that's where the biggest difference between these bands lie. I think when we talk about their studio work and all that, very similar, very disciplined. But I think, like what you guys had stated, when it comes to on the road, it's like, you know, Zeppelin was known for being decadent, but that was off the stage. I mean, there's stuff that some of the stuff that they did was legendary, how drunk and crazy Bonham would get and all this other stuff. But when it came to showtime, they went up there and they just went, you know, they went through
professionals.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's because you have the situation where Page and John Paul Jones were more studio. They were session musicians before they really got into it. So I think that professionalism always kind of went over. It was like, okay, it's time to do the show. These people paid it. They want to hear this stuff the way that we had it on the record. And where the, you know, I probably outside of what Entwistle, the rest of the Who at that time, they were, you know, just a collection of guys. I mean, they weren't really session guys. So I don't know. I don't know too much of Pete Townsend's I know he was a club guy, but I don't know how much of how much studio or session work he did before The Who, if he did any. That's that being, I think that's the biggest case, because like you guys are talking about, when you're looking at these concert videos, it's like The Who, you just don't know what's going on. And Zeppelin, you know, you kind of know, especially like watching The Song Remains the Same. It's like, that was what, two nights at Madison Square Garden. Well, you know, when they went to Boston then the following night, it was probably pretty much the same show. I mean, incredible, but you know, because of the songs, but not too much guitar smashing or
exploding drum kits.
Yeah, or like you said, taking a song and you know stretching it out till, you know, 10, 15 minutes. Zeppelin wrote songs that were 10 and 15 minutes long.
But they played them pretty much the same.
Yeah, exactly. So.
All right. I think we're starting to wind down. Let's do favorites from each band and then who wins in a fight. All right?
Sure.
All right. Yeah. So on the Who side of things, I'm going to say favorite member, Keith Moon. Favorite album is Quadrophenia. Favorite song is I Am One, which is, I believe, off the same.
Probably, if I'm going to go to The Who, I always liked Daughtry. I thought there was always something kind of, you know, a lot of people always said, oh, him and Plant are lookalikes and, you know, and stuff like that. But there was always something a little bit more harder edge in him. It's like, you could see that if he was on your side, he'd get in a fight no problem and actually kick some major ass, where with Plant, it's like he'd probably just want to sit down and chill out and you know, get all the negative vibes out of there. But I like Daughtry. I'd have probably agree with you with Quadrophenia. It is a great album, and even though this might be very, I don't know, mainstream, my song that whenever I hear Who play and I they're on the radio or whatever and I turn it up is Teenage Wasteland. I think that's just a really solid, and it's one of those songs that can kind of go across generations. And I think that's why you have these two bands, why people now still listen to them. People, you know, in their teens and early 20s are still listening to these two bands because a lot of the things that they say and do is, you know, it transcends. And but that's it for me on The Who.
Good stuff. Favorite album? It's got to be The Who Sell Out, just because of the added. If you get the reissue, it has some of the commercials they were doing at the time. On an album, you know, that was supposed to be, you know, very anti-commercial, so I appreciate the irony in that. Favorite member, gotta be John Entwistle. I saw this one DVD clip a long time ago of it was an isolated bass track of him, and it just brought on a completely new appreciation for bass players who I thought up until that point were just, you know, kind of guys who just stayed there and, you know, tried to not draw a lot of attention themselves. Favorite song, Boris the Spider. From the early, days.
No, actually, one thing that's awesome about Boris the Spider is that they, on a lot of the live versions, they lead into that with Edvard Grieg's Hall of the Mountain King, which is just so cool.
Yeah, I forgot about that. I haven't heard that song in a long time.
Oh, another Who cover I love is they do the Batman song. Like they're the,
oh my God! That's
they're the reason why people think the Batman song has lyrics.
Wow!
Yeah,
that's fantastic. Batman spins a web wherever he can. Okay, Led Zeppelin.
Zeppelin.
Okay. Favorite member for me, I like Bonzo. He's just an animal. He would drink Jack Daniels like it was water. Favorite album.
Tough. That's
it
tough.
Is. The one I find myself going back to the most is 3, but I think I like oh God, I'm totally blanking on the name of it. It's the one that comes before Physical Graffiti. Houses of the Holy. That's the one that has.
It's like the forgotten album.
Yeah, exactly. And the one that it took them forever to finish the painting on the front, and it still wasn't done. By the time it's like, okay, forget it. We'll just go with what we have. And favorite song, I'm gonna say it again, No Quarter. It's not the typical Led Zeppelin song, but it's just very moody and creepy, and it's something that just is really fascinating to me, and I find myself going back to it a lot. I love it.
Okay. Led Zeppelin. Favorite member, I would probably have to say Page. Jimmy Page, just because, like I had stated earlier, I think he is one of the most underrated guitarists out there. He's and possibly because he's a hero of one of my favorite guitarists growing up. I was a huge Megadeth fan, and Dave Mustaine has said on many times that Jimmy Page is his his guy. So and I agree, because a lot of things that he did. Song, it's tough, and I'm just gonna have to split it between two. One, it's one significance, and one's just because of the song itself. But the Misty Mountain Hop is one of my favorite songs, actually.
Nice.
And a lot of it goes when I was growing up. Me and my best friend, that we just freaking we just would rock out to that song all the time. But the other one that I love is on Physical Graffiti, The Rover. The thing about The Rover is just the way it starts. You have just kind of that slow guitar riff building up, joined in with Bonzo, and it's one of the really harder songs of Zeppelin, and one of the songs that's not really played that much, or if people even really know about it. So definitely check that out. Album, this is tough. I agree with you on Houses of the Holy. But the other one that I tend to listen to a lot, and I think it's one of those albums where you can just go from start to finish, is Two. I think Two is just because it's got a real raw sound, and some of Page's really great guitar work is on there. You know, between like the Lemon Song and Heartbreaker, and I mean, just pretty good stuff. So
I love Bring It On Home.
Yeah. I mean, it's and I mean, even as crazy as A Whole Lot of Love is, if you take out the lyrics, the song's amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just sit there and listen to it, and you're like, my God. And you can see that song has influenced a lot of bands.
Absolutely.
From that point on. But
all right, I'm going to have to say favorite member is John Bonham. Just, he changed a lot of how drums sound in rock and roll, and was so good at it. Like, you listen to Moby Dick, and my God, that man can bang up.
How about, some stems. How about the drums on When the Levee Breaks?
When the Levee
Breaks. I've never heard drums that sound like it. Just so big and just like,
well, it almost sounds like explosions.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that is just so kind of noticeable with him. It's back when like Metallica used to be good, and and except the
what do you have
album.
Against St. Andrews?
I'm not even going to go into that. But you know, when Lars had that, you know, the machine gun. The machine gun sound that with the drums, and you know, it's just that distinctive thing where when you can know a band and you can hear a song and you just hear the drummer and you know what band it is and you know what who it is playing it. That was Bonham. It's like Rush. I mean, you as soon as you hear the drums, you know, and then you hear a squealing guy.
So. Favorite song? I'm gonna say When the Levee Breaks. Just that just is a lot of fun to listen to. You sit, you listen, and you rock back and forth.
Exactly. It's just in the harmonica. I love that track.
Like a lot of Zeppelin songs, you just respond to physically before you respond to it on any other level.
And one of the, and it has one of the best wrap ups at the end of the song, that whole, you know, it's just like, it, you go from like this, cause it's like, what, about 5, 6, 7 minutes long?
It's one of their,
I mean,
long,
it's a long song. And it's just like, you think it's over, and then it's just got that quick little thing at the end with the guitar, and it's like, wow, that's pretty cool.
All right. And favorite album? Led Zeppelin 1. From like, yes, beginning to end, you can just listen to that, and it's such rocking out good times.
Your time is gonna come.
Time is gonna come. But even off the beginning, like from Jump with Good Times, Bad Times is, you know you're in for like some great music just off that.
Well, that's always, to me, that's always been the stamp of a great album, is you just hit play or you just put it in the CD player and it just goes. And you don't have to sit there and go, it's one of those things, even depending on what mood you're in at that day, it's like, you know, I'm not really feeling this song. I'm just going to hit, you know, hit seek or hit fast forward. Yeah, I'd agree with you. It's tough with the Zeppelin, with their albums, because a lot of their albums are so pretty solid, and there's so many hits off of them.
Gonna go into who is deadliest.
Oh, okay, cool.
And
glad I didn't miss this.
All right, so I think, let's just say, for the sake of fairness, let's pick like some random year in the mid-70s for them for this hypothetical fight. And
what year did Who's Next come out?
Hmm?
What year did Who's Next come out?
Who's Next was
72?
Yeah, it's early 70s, I believe.
Oh, I'm looking at the singles, that's why.
Wikipedia ho.
Yeah.
Wikipedia ho.
Relations, live album, studio. Okay, Who's Next was 71.
Okay.
Okay.
So that was up against Led Zeppelin 4. So, okay, let's say they're both at the height of their powers.
Okay.
All right. Now,
Everyone's alive.
Everyone's alive. Everyone's reasonably fit.
Yeah, the addictions hasn't taken over.
But they're still messed up enough to be really violent.
Yes.
I think I got to give this to The Who, just because I think Bonham and Keith Moon go somewhere and passed out on stuff even by then. And Roger Daltrey is just freaking deadly with a Gibson.
Yeah, I think. Well, I don't know if Bonzo would. I don't. I think he would have fought. He would have kept fighting until he passed out. It would have been one of those things where, I think, he would have done damage, but after about 10 swings, he'd just fall over.
Yeah.
Because he'd just pass out. Yeah. If we're doing a fight, I don't think Zeppelin's gonna win, because.
Oh no. Jimmy Page, like, is frail and just shriveled up.
Yeah, and he's not really a fighter, and it's like I stated before with Daltrey and Robert Plant. Robert Plant is a pretty boy at that time, and John Paul Jones, he could be the one guy that could surprise you, but the fact that half the group can't really fight and the other part of the group is passed out after swinging a few times, yeah, because you can tell. I think Daughtry'd be the one kicking the most ass.
Oh yeah,
ass,
no, like he's good for three guys, really.
Because to me, Townsend's a little bit of a sissy, I think, when it comes to stuff like that. I think he's the type of guy, he'd talk big, but he'd probably get popped in the nose and probably start crying. So.
Yeah, Daughtry
just looks like one of those typical British bar brawlers.
Yeah, seriously.
soccer hooligan.
Yeah, I don't really see any way that The Who could lose to Zeppelin in a street fight. I just,
yeah,
like you said, Bonham would probably pass out halfway through, and when you have, you know, John Paul Jones is like your main fighter. You know, it's not bad, but I mean, certainly not good either. You're not doing yourself any favors. So I got to give this one to The Who for sure.
Yeah, John Paul Jones would he would find that nerd strength. You know,
yeah, exactly.
He'd be that kid in high school that people used to mess with, and then all of a sudden he gets that breaking point and he just goes ape-ass all over people.
But, slap fight.
Yeah. And what about ladder match?
Ooh.
Oh,
ladders. I don't know. I don't trust any of them to climb that high.
Oh, Bonham or Keith Moon. Yeah. I think they would get like the third or fourth step and just throw up on themselves.
Ladder matches do not favor rock stars.
No. I don't think there's any. I don't think there's any way that we could put a fight together where, Zeppelin would beat The Who. I even think if it was 4-on-1, if you just had Roger Daughtry versus Led Zeppelin, he'd kick all their asses. And I don't know. The Who, it goes to The Who on this
just
one.
Just gotta go with The Who on this one. And with that, let's call that a show.
Was that just like a clinking glasses?
That was me dropping something off the desk.
It sounded exactly like, you know, going cheers to somebody. That was
all
awesome.
All right, in that case, I'm not cutting it.
Leave it in.
Rolling with that. All right, we will do some more music episodes in the future. Not sure what. Feel free to make suggestions in the talkback thread for this. Till then, see ya.
I thought they smelled bad on the outside.
I thought they smelled bad on the outside. Please enter a Creative Commons license. Check out our website at sbopodcast.blogspot.com. Check us out on Twitter at sbopodcast or our Facebook page at I Thought They Smelled Bad on the Outside. Or kick me an email at sbopodcast@gmail.com.